Good afternoon. My name is Pat Bricey, and I'm new to the job at the CDC, as Lynn said in her introduction. So I have a 30-year academic career behind me, and I'm now wrestling with what it means to be part of a government agency and head a center within the CDC that's focused on environmental health. So there's a lot of challenges with moving from the government, from the university to the government. And so it's been an exciting experience for me. And I'm told I have to stop saying I'm new. I get to spend the first year saying I'm new, but after the January 1st, I have to stop saying I'm new. But when I was considering taking the job, I called a number of colleagues, and I was asked about what they thought about the National Center for Environmental Health. And obviously, I called people CDC, but I called more broadly at my environmental health friends and colleagues. And a lot of people said CDC has a Center for Environmental Health. This was kind of the response I got. So the CDC is obviously a big agency. It's known mostly and probably appropriately as an agency that deals with infectious diseases. And it's got a strong health focus, as Lynn said in her introduction, but probably the environmental side of what CDC does is not well understood by people and not well appreciated by people. And I think that's one of the challenges I had when I taken on this job. And one of the things I'd like to address by giving talks like this, and I'd like to begin by giving the obligatory, I have no relationship to disclose with respect to giving this presentation.
I meant to say that too.
So I want to start with, Tom gave the mission at the end, but I want to start with the mission. And I think what's important, we can spend some time talking about during the discussion, is that you'll see that the mission of the three agencies that we represent, there's a lot of overlap between that. And I think one of the challenges we have today is how do we harness that overlap? How do we make sure that the resources are used as efficiently as possible so we get the best bang for the buck, so we do the most good that we can? So the mission of the National Center for Environmental Health and HSDR, if I'll just digress for one moment. So HSDR and NCH are two separate things if you don't know that. They're linked through me as a common director. They have very similar activities that they do, very similar communities that they address, but they really are separate. And one of the challenges of my job is to make sure that I keep these two separate agencies working together, but also maintain their independence because they want to make sure they stay independent as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about HSDR and I'm talking a little about NCH on the side, but they really are separate. And I think it's important to recognize that because their strengths that they bring as separate agencies and thinking about how we use those strengths is part of, I think, what I have to do as part of my job. So the mission is to protect people's health from environmental hazards that can be present in the air we breathe, the water we drink, the world that sustains us. So this is pretty much bread and butter for environmental health community. So we do this by investigating the relationships between environmental factors and health, and we don't always do those investigations ourselves. We rely heavily on the science that's generated by the NIH and NIEHS in particular. We are not a regulatory agency, unlike part of what EPA's mission is, but we generate guidance. So a lot of times we can translate what we know from the science into guidance, and we build partnerships to support healthy decision making. So a lot of what we do at CDC, as well as the National Center for Environmental Health, is we work closely with local and state health departments to implement programs that protect people's health. So the guidance we provide, the support we provide, is oftentimes directly to local and state health departments. And on average, about 70% of the funding that comes into National Center for Environmental Health goes to local and state health departments. So there's an environmental health infrastructure in this country that Tom knows a lot about that we don't talk often about, but that starts at local and cities, states, and this infrastructure is what's crucial to maintaining the healthy environment that we all take for granted today in terms of where does our garbage go, where does our clean water come from. The things that aren't as sexy as climate change necessarily. But that important infrastructure is a large part of what we do and we support at the National Center for Environmental Health. So we have a number of priorities in the National Center for Environmental Health. So fortunately, before I got there, we did some strategic planning. I say that fortunately because I'm not a fan of strategic planning. It's to do it right, it's a lot of work. And having done it multiple times, at least in an academic setting, the last thing I want to do coming to a new job is start with strategic planning. So we're going to address that. But I think the strategic priorities are in line with what everybody thinks is important. And so the first one is to reduce asthma, morbidity, and mortality. And so we know that asthma is a disease. We don't know a lot about what causes asthma, but we know a lot about what makes asthma worse, what makes asthma bad. And if there's one thing that I know from my research at Johns Hopkins that we should be able to have a big impact, it's on asthma. And this is also something where we can work across federal agencies from HUD to EPA to NIEHS to make this happen. And why we haven't had put a bigger dent in the asthma morbidity and mortality in this country today, why we still have a large asthma disparity, is something that I think we have to answer for, because we should be able to reduce the asthma disparity. We should eliminate, we should be able to cut back on a lot of the morbidity and mortality associated with asthma, especially childhood asthma. So as confident with across the federal government, we have a strong focus on children's environmental health, and there's lots of sessions here at the conference. I don't have time to spend all the reasons why children are more susceptible, things we all understand, but that's an important focus of the NCH and ATSDR. We want to ensure safe drinking water. When I was at Johns Hopkins, if you talk to people about environmental health and ask them what the number one challenge facing the world today, they almost all said water in some way or another. Tom mentioned water. There's so many facets to clean water and safe water. We have to make sure we have water for agriculture, we make water for industry, for recreation, for drinking. And we have to do that in the face of unprecedented challenges with respect to climate change. And so the clean water is an important strategic priority of ours. And then finally, one of the things that we bring to the world that I'm most proud of is our laboratory. So the laboratory, the Division of Laboratory Sciences, defines what we mean by biomonitoring today, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And so making sure that the laboratory stays a strong part of CDC is an important strategic priority. So I'm just going to talk about ATSDR in a minute. So Tom mentioned Love Canal. So Love Canal is where ATSDR started, a little bit of history. And after Love Canal, in 1980, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act, CERCLA, also known as Superfund, established ATSDR. So it gave EPA the responsibility for identifying, investigating, and cleaning up hazardous waste sites. And it asked ATSDR to perform public health assessments. So the public health component of hazardous waste investigations is what's on the shoulders of ATSDR. Develop toxicological profiles on harmful substances. So these are we want to look at all the health information, and we want to publish documents that hopefully most of you are familiar about. We call tox profiles. Where appropriate, we conduct epidemiological studies in communities around hazardous waste sites. Then we maintain health registries and conduct medical surveillance around hazardous waste sites. This is a huge mandate. And it's a mandate that we do our best to fulfill, but I can tell you right now that the resources it takes to really fulfill this mandate don't come anywhere near close to what really should be done. If we want to look at the burden of hazardous waste and hazardous waste releases and chemical releases in communities across the country, and the expectations of citizens for agencies like ours, it's very frustrating because the expectations are huge, the needs are large, and the resources are quite modest, to be honest. So this is a map that just shows the country, and every dot here is a hazardous waste site in the last 10 years that we've been involved with. So you can see the magnitude of the problem, just in terms of geographic distribution and what we have to get involved with. And remember I said I have these two hats that I wear at CDC, and I spend a lot of my time with communities and problems associated with hazardous waste that ATSDR has to deal with, from acute spills. My wife, who's in the audience, will tell you it was my first week on the job. There was a pipeline break in the Yellowstone River in Montana in the middle of the winter, and we're getting called at 2:00 in the morning to help. The state of Montana wants to know, should we turn the water treatment plant on? And they're asking us for advice about when they could turn it back on. And so this is a key function that we provide. And of course, we work very closely with EPA in terms of looking at the water for contamination. But it's very hard to think about turning off the water for a whole community in the middle of the winter. And of course, they want to have it come on as soon as possible. But you have to make very sure that the water is clean before you let it back on. And you learn about all these nuances now about how do you clean a distribution system that's been contaminated. How do you tell people to make sure that the water coming out of their tap is safe once the distribution system has been, once the water coming in the treatment plant is clear. So these are all huge issues. And these types of spills happen on a weekly basis across the U.S. And just so managing this, keeping up on this is a huge burden. So the other aspects of ATSDR that I'll just mention very briefly is In terms of providing medical support to the community, along with EPA, we help support the pediatric environmental health specialty units, the PACEUs, right? So there's a big need to provide medical support to the pediatric community around issues with chemical contamination in kids. And we do that primarily through the PACEUs, which is a very important program. It's a gem, and I think it's not as recognized for the strength that it brings to the country. As I said before, we produce toxicological profiles. We help develop technology and tools in terms of risk assessment and risk management. We provide environmental medicine support. So we have clinicians specialized in environmental medicine who work with communities. And of course, we do health studies and we set up registries. So some notable registries are the World Trade Center Registry we established, the Living Montana Registry for Asbestos in Living Montana. And we also have resources to set up an ALS registry within ATSDR as well. So that's just a flavor for the ATSDR side of things. So I'd like to spend a few minutes about the National Center for Environmental Health. And so in terms of the history, it was established in 1980 as the Center for Environmental Health at CDC. It focused on preventing disability, disease, and death due to environmental factors. In 1987, it was renamed the Center for Environmental Health and Injury Control, with the growing appreciation that injury prevention was an important part of environmental health. And in 1992, it split into two centers as injury became more and more important and started developing its own programs. The Center for Injury Prevention was spun off, and the Center for Environmental Health now stands. And they added national to the title of the two centers in 1992, recognizing that we had this national scope to what we do. So the main activities of the National Center for Environmental Health are, like I said at the beginning, we support local and state and tribal communities through training and technical assistance. We have a large communication education function. We set standards, guidelines, and recommendations to support our public health practice. We participate in public health, environmental health surveillance, and we do applied research across a variety of venues, from epi studies to behavioral interventions and statistical analyses as well. So it's a big agency with a lot going on. And one of the things I'd like to just talk about today, because I really think it's something that's key to advancing environmental health in the future, is the Division of Laboratory Sciences. The Division of Laboratory Sciences is the world's best laboratory for conducting measurements on biological samples for chemicals and nutritional factors. So they specialize in doing things that no other laboratory can do. They look at small amounts of blood. They have quick turnaround. They look at unique profiles of chemicals. They have unrivaled quality assurance in terms of precision, sensitivity, specificity. They're geared up for disaster response, so that if there's a chemical spill or if there's a terrorist attack or some preparedness effort needs, we can turn around samples if we need to in a matter of days, in many cases, if not hours. So we also support an important laboratory infrastructure across the country. So we support laboratories around the country to help duplicate this as well, recognizing that the CDC can't do everything. But one of the things that the lab does is it supports the National Biomonitoring Program, and it does this through developing new and improved high-quality biomonitoring methods for providing chemicals. We assess the U.S. population's exposure to these chemicals through things like the NHANES program. And then we also provide unique measurements for vulnerable populations, special studies. And one of the things that we provide that's a great use to the world is the National Report on Human Exposure to Environmental Chemicals. So this is a report that we publish in paper copy, I think every 5 years, but we update it electronically every year. It's the most comprehensive assessment of Americans' exposure to environmental chemicals. And it gives biomonitoring data for 300 plus chemicals, including pesticides, metals, and things that we encounter in every day. So just a few examples of the impact of this is that, for example, the program through the detection of phthalates has led to labeling phthalate-containing medical devices. The bisphenol A was removed from food packaging in part because we noticed that the increase in bisphenol A in biomonitoring, we traced back where it came from. And we're also leading to the removal of polybrominated diphenyl ethers from certain carpets and furniture applications. Again, as we see these chemicals rise in the blood of people over time, scientists, environmental health professionals start asking, where does it come from? When we start understanding where it comes from, this leads to important public health action. So one of the other programs I'd like to emphasize, Tom mentioned this already, thanks for introducing it, Tom, is the Environmental Health Public Health Tracking Program. Now, the Center for Environmental Health does lots of things, so I'm going to emphasize the laboratory and the tracking program in particular. So this was created in 2002 in response to a Pew Commission report that recommended nationwide health tracking network for diseases and exposures. So the Public Health Tracking Program, I'm told it's not a great name, but this is environment health surveillance. So CDC, the heart of what we do at CDC is surveillance. So this is our environmental health surveillance program. And I encourage you all to look at this. So I'm going to show you a couple screenshots. And it's a program that I don't think I think it's underutilized. I don't think it's appreciated as much as it could. And if you just search for CDC tracking, you'll come to a page like this, and this just shows you the launch page. So I encourage you all to do that. So we support 26 grantees, 25 states and one city to participate in the tracking program. So you see the coverage here on the map. To be really effective, I'd love for this to be a national program. I'd like to have every state participating. But there's lots of aspects to the program, including fellowship programs, so that we support states to train people to do public health tracking. And you'll see in the purple diamonds on the map, for example, states that get the fellows, and the blue diamonds are the states that get the fellows, and the purple diamonds are the cities that get the fellows. So this is our opportunity now to reach out to states that don't have a tracking program to get resources into those states so they can develop tracking, so hopefully they can apply for grants in the future. So the tracking network is a surveillance program. And the surveillance program is only good as the questions it can answer and the people who use it to solve important public health problems. So within the tracking network, there's data on asthma. There's all sorts of biomonitoring data. You'll see them listed here. There's information on birth defects, cancer, carbon monoxide poisoning, and a variety of other exposure and health-related factors. And so I encourage you all to look at the public health tracking website. It's an important resource that allows us to look at the relationship between factors in the environment and disease patterns. So just one quick example is there's a number of states have used a tracking program to look at the overlap between private wells and arsenic-bearing rock. So this is areas now that we know that the private wells need to be tested for arsenic. So it's a way states can now target the resources more efficiently, and they can address important public health problems, in this case arsenic in drinking water. So we also have a large asthma program, and we don't need to spend a lot of time talking about the problems with asthma, the high prevalence of asthma and the high cost of asthma. And you see a graphic here that as you follow it over time, it just looks at the changing asthma prevalence. And as you see, as it goes over time, you know, the colors go from the lighter to the darker shade as well. So this is the asthma epidemic that I talked about at the beginning of my talk. And this is something that we need to focus on fixing this. And it's a big health and economic burden on the country. To approach this, we have a national asthma control program, again, where we give resources to states to develop asthma control programs. You see a map here of the states that we fund. And so we fund state organizations. And we develop asthma quality measures so they can measure how they're impacting asthma, and hopefully we inform policymakers across the states as well through this asthma control program. We have a safe water program. Now this is going to be, I put this in because this is something that we take for granted, but I can tell you, I met with congressional staffers not too long ago, and I had a staffer ask me, so why do we need a safe water program at CDC? And so just the fact that I have that discussion, I mean, illustrates to me the importance of talking to people about safe water. And so there's a big gap that we fill in terms of safe water that's not addressed by the EPA. The EPA regulates and helps with municipal water supplies. There's a lot of aspects of water quality that are not regulated by the EPA that local and state health departments need help with, including local well water supplies, dealing with chemical contamination, dealing with spills, for example. So this is another example using the tracking network. As I mentioned before, this is an example of a county in Iowa that's able to look at the intersection between arsenic-bearing rock and water samples. So they can, as I mentioned before, they can target their arsenic testing to those wells where it's needed. Another area that's coming up related to increasing with climate change is harmful algal blooms. So many municipal water supplies right now are challenged by harmful algal blooms, and they release mycotoxins that get into the drinking water. And this is the big problem that first hit the national stage was Toledo, Ohio, and the water affecting 500,000 people get their drinking water from Lake Erie. And water treatment systems aren't designed to remove, in many cases, fungal toxins. And the medical community isn't ready to talk about what the health effects of the fungal toxins are. And even the veterinary community are not readily prepared to talk about what the health effects of these things are. So we provided crucial support to state in order to respond to potential harmful algal blooms. And now this is almost an annual thing. Not almost, it is an annual thing. And many state localities now gear up for these algal blooms every spring, and we provide important guidance to them on how to deal with it. So that's another example. So we have additional things that I won't have time to talk about. We have programs on air pollution and respiratory health. We have programs on some of the other kind of rising challenges that Tom mentioned before. We have a built environment and health initiative. We support the country's chemical weapons elimination program. So believe it or not, we're still eliminating chemical weapons in this country. And the Army and the Department of Defense cannot open up a chemical weapons destruction facility without our approval, which is something I found out. And so they have to make sure that we have to make sure that they're doing it right, they're doing it safe, and all the control systems are working before they start destroying chemical weapons. And I had the pleasure of visiting one of those facilities couple months ago. We have a childhood lead prevention poisoning program. We have a climate and health program. We support a variety of environmental health services, including food safety, restaurant inspections at the state level. We do health studies. We support newborn screening through the Division of Laboratory Sciences. We measure nutritional indicators, as I said before. We do radiation studies. And what my kids think one of the coolest part about my job is our vegetable sanitation program. So whenever there's an outbreak on a cruise ship, we go out and investigate it for them. And so that's like doing a mini health inspection on a cruise ship. And when they come in, they have to clean the cruise ship to our standards. And they don't get to sail until we say they can sail, which is a cool part of my job. So I tell my kids that I can tell cruise ships they can't sail. Of course, we never tell a cruise ship they can't sail, because all you have to do is say you're not ready to sail, and they'll say, okay, we'll clean the ship one more time. Because the last thing they want is in the news to say the CDC ordered them not to sail. But you know, that's an important thing that we do when you think of the millions of people that go on cruise ships every year. While cruise ships aren't totally free from outbreaks, it would be a lot worse if we weren't providing this crucial resource to that industry and to this country. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to John Bobas. So thank you very much.